economic recovery has continued at a moderate pace in recent quarters, despite the strong headwinds created by federal fiscal policy.
I think the biggest issue we have today, bigger than even for the tax policy, is this whole retirement issue.
This is High on Your Money with Gary Rathman, President and CEO of Private Wealth Consultants. Your free market voice.
Free market voice.
Of the Midwest. Call Gary, 855-334-4556. Gary Rathman has over 30 years of experience in making the best choices for you to keep more of what you earn. Educational, real, relevant. High on Your Money with Gary Rathman.
This is our country.
Good evening and welcome again to High on Your Money, your free market voice of the Midwest. I am Gary Rathman. Our number here, 855-334-4556. Toll free from anywhere, 855-334-4556. Our website's iOnYourMoney.com, iOnYourMoney.com, and PrivateWealthConsultants.com, PrivateWealthConsultants.com. What else? Oh, Facebook. Facebook is Private Wealth Consultants LTD, Private Wealth Consultants LTD Limited. And also, don't forget to get familiar with and download the app for iHeartRadio. There are times when part of the show or all of the show is preempted in some of our markets by baseball, basketball, football, whatever. And but we make sure that it is streamed live through iHeartRadio. And it's a terrific app, by the way. Clear Channel came up with a great idea on iHeart. You can program your own stations and listen to everything in the United States and all kinds of stuff. But we're on iHeartRadio at the same time we're on live. So make sure you get that app on your smartphone, iPad, computer, whatever, and you can hear the show from anywhere. Today is tax day, and I got to tell you, I'm not enjoying it. Okay, I'll be better tomorrow or Thursday maybe, but I do not like what I had to go through today. And I'm one of these guys. I mean, I pay all my quarterlies. I pay everything I'm supposed to pay throughout the year and that kind of stuff. I feel it's important from an integrity standpoint. If I'm handling other people's money as a career, that I should pay all my taxes and not cheat Uncle Sam at all. And but I tell you, this is the one day a year that I don't like seeing the bank account move like it moved today. So anyway, that being said, we're going to spend tonight, virtually all of tonight, talking about taxes, income taxes, a little bit on estate taxes, a little bit on the IRS, some of the things going on there or that have gone on there. We got some people tried taking some really odd deductions. We'll talk about that just for entertainment value. And I'll probably touch on, if we have time tonight, I'll probably touch on what's going on with the ranch or the rancher Bundy out in Nevada. Some interesting stuff happened there over the weekend. And I'll give you my opinion and my take on that. I think that there's some positive things to be had there, and also some negative things that we need to look at. But today is tax day. Two more days, the 17th, is Tax Freedom Day, meaning that if we worked the entire year and gave Uncle Sam all of our money between January 1 and April 17th, then we could keep our money the rest of the year. So that's almost a third of everything we make just going to Uncle Sam, not counting the state and local income taxes that are on top of that. In fact, I saw an article, I got to hear somewhere, we may touch on it later, that, lists out 97 different taxes that you and I pay. And I don't know if you saw it or not, it was on, I think it was on Drudge Report, either today or yesterday, but, and I didn't get time to research the background of other presidents, but it said since President Obama's been in office that he has proposed, sticks in my mind, like 442 tax increases. So that's 4 or 5 tax years and or budgets or whatever you want to call it, and 442 proposals for tax increases. Now, what I wanted to do is find out how many proposals other presidents have had for tax increases and see how that fares. You know, we've talked, this is a side note, we've talked a little bit about how many executive orders President Obama has signed, and he's still running behind President Bush and President Clinton, I believe, at this time in their tenure as president as to how many executive orders they sign. That doesn't take into consideration the severity of the order or the impact of the executive order. I think that that is hard to quantify as an overall number in a short period of time. And, of course, it would be somewhat subjective. But I'd like to see how many income tax increases previous presidents have had through their first 5 years or so. But 442 is still a lot. That's a lot of tax increases. Now, some of those were reinstatement of taxes that expired. It was elimination of deductions and exemptions, that kind of stuff. So it's not like it appears where he's coming out and saying, okay, in addition to all the other taxes, we're going to add some more necessarily. Some of them are that. Okay. Today, many people are experiencing the first time that 3.8% increase in tax rates for paying for Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, if you make over $200,000 as a single, $250,000 as a household. So we're going to talk about all this stuff. We're going to talk a little bit about the opinion of taxes and how that affects the overall economy and capitalism. And, you know, the top 1%, the top 10, the top 20, the top 50%, these aren't bad people. And it's important that we look at how raising the taxes on the top 10%, top 20%, top 1%, even the top 0.1%, how that affects all of us. It's easy to sit back and say, well, you know what, that tax increase, that doesn't affect me. That 3.8 Affordable Care Act surcharge, that's $250,000 of income per household or higher. That really doesn't affect me, so I don't care. Well, you know what? You should care for a couple reasons. One, someday it might affect you. Two, directly. Two, it affects you indirectly in the sense that that is more capital, more money sucked out of the economy that can't be put to use elsewhere. So, anybody know, and this is a rhetorical question, I don't want you calling in with the answer necessarily. Anybody know where or when the income tax started? Most people will say it started in 1913, because that was the 16th Amendment was passed when Wyoming, the 36th state to approve a constitutional amendment, made it a law then, or part of the Constitution, giving Congress the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. Now, that language was chosen very carefully. And when we come back, we'll talk about why that language was chosen, and you'll find out when the first income tax really started. It was long before 1913 in this country. I'm Gary Rathman. This is Eye on Your Money. We'll be right back.
Now back to Eye on Your Money with Gary Rathman.
We are back. Our number here, 855-334-4556. Toll free from anywhere. If you want to give us a call, please feel free. I forgot to mention two things. One, two nights from now, Harry Verreiser will be joining me. He's the author of the book, Didn't Have to Be This Way. And we've had him on before. He's a great guy, professor, and very interesting perspective on business and the economy and entrepreneurship and what regulation has done. So coming up in a couple nights, make sure that you mark on your calendar, Harry Verreiser. Another important one, a week from tonight, next Tuesday night, Kathy Jackson will be joining us. Kathy Jackson. Now, I rarely do this, but I'm going to ask you to get as many people as you can tuned in. Kathy Jackson is she's an author of a book called The Cornered Cat, C-A-T. And she's been a contributor and a contributing editor to Concealed Carry magazine. And she has a long list of articles that she's written. You'll want to look her up if you can. But she's going to be joining us for a full half hour. She's out on the West Coast. I think she lives in Washington State. But my wife picked up this book at a gun show a couple months ago and read through it, very fascinated by it. So I picked it up and read through it. And it's a terrific book. But she's going to talk to us about some of the thought processes and things you need to consider from a concealed carry standpoint. She specializes in, well, her book, The Cornered Cat, is a woman's guide to concealed carry. But like I said, I read through it and there was a lot of things that applied to me. I didn't really feel the need to pick up a concealed carry purse for myself, but that's another story. But anyway, next Tuesday night, she'll be joining us. And I would encourage you to get as many people as you can to listen. And I think the ladies in our audience will be especially interested in what she has to say. She's a lot of fun to talk to, and she's extraordinarily smart on concealed carry and some of the aspects around that. So next Tuesday night, Kathy Jackson, author of The Cornered Cat, will be joining us. And we've got some other guests coming up in the next few weeks. And as we get closer, we'll let you know who those are. Okay, 1913 is when the states passed, when Wyoming became the 36th state. So we needed three-fourths of the states to agree with the amendment and pass it on a state level for it to become part of the Constitution, the 16th Amendment. And this allowed Congress to have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. Now, at the time, 1913, the tax rate was 1% tax on net personal income of more than $3,000 a year, with a surtax of 6% on incomes of more than $500,000. So this is where the first 1040 was created. I encourage you to Google the first 1040 and see how simple that looks. I mean, it's 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%, 6% maximum on incomes over $500,000. So it's interesting to look at that, and that's as close to a flat tax as the United States has ever been. Essentially, I mean, it's very, very simple. Segregated out dividends and other forms of income over two or three lines, and then you figured out the tax. And on the second page, it did give you the ability to describe the income. And on the third page, gave you a few deductions. So very simple, probably a 5-minute process in filling out the tax return. But the income tax, or tax on income, was originally started in 1862 under President Lincoln. And he signed into law what he called a revenue-raising measure to help pay for the Civil War. And it created a Commissioner of Internal Revenue and the nation's first income tax. And that was 3% on incomes between $600 and $10,000 a year, and 5% on incomes more than $10,000. So 1862, President Lincoln, first president to create an income tax. Now, prior to that, from, all the way up to 1913. In 1867, Congress cut the tax rate. And from 1868 to 1913, 90% of all revenue came from taxes on liquor, beer, wine, and tobacco. So in 1872, the income tax was repealed. And 1894, the Wilson Tariff Act revived the income tax, and an income tax division within the Bureau of Internal Revenue was created. Now, finally, in 1895, the Supreme Court ruled that the new income tax was unconstitutional on the grounds that it was a direct tax and not apportioned, remember that word, among the states on the basis of population. And that's why the 16th Amendment has that language in it. I'm Gary Rathman. This is Eye on Your Money. We'll be back in just a minute.
Now back to Eye on Your Money with Gary Rathman.
We are back. It's interesting to look at the evolution of income tax and the revenue and the IRS. It wasn't called the IRS until under President Eisenhower. And but I mean, think about this. Remember what I said, that 90% of all the revenue came from taxes on liquor, beer, wine, and tobacco. And 1913, that became a income tax became a constitutional amendment, 16th Amendment. And in 1918, just 5 years later, of course, we were up to our eyeballs in World War I, and the income tax rate went to, you ready, 77% in order to finance the war. 1919, the states ratified the 18th Amendment. 18th Amendment, essentially drawing up the country. I mean, it barred the manufacture, sale, or transport of intoxicating beverages. So these were the products that generated 90% of the revenue for the federal government. And we passed a constitutional amendment. Constitutional amendment. You know how hard that is to pass an amendment? It's got to get 67 votes in Congress. It's got to get, I forget what, 75%, I believe, in the House, whatever that number is. And then 75% of the states have to ratify it before it becomes a constitutional amendment. Consequently, the same action has to take place in order to get rid of a constitutional amendment. And you don't really get rid of a constitutional amendment. You just get another one nullifying the previous one. So in 1918, the Revenue Act of 1918, essentially, or I'm sorry, 1919, ratified 18th Amendment, barred the manufacture, sale, and transport of alcohol, intoxicating beverages. Okay, so you can see the evolution of this and why the income tax became more and more and more important. So the Revenue Act of 1942, hailed by President Roosevelt at the time, the greatest tax bill in American history, passed Congress. It increased the taxes and the number of Americans subject to the income tax. It also created deductions for medical and investment expenses. Now, important point or important date is 1943, and that was the Congress passed the what they call the Current Tax Payment Act, which essentially made all employers agents of the Internal Revenue Service, even though it wasn't called the Internal Revenue Service at the time. I understand that. But that was where it required employers to withhold taxes from employees' wages and remit them to the federal government on a quarterly basis. Okay. So 1943 was an important year. And I still say that if everybody had to do what I did today, if everybody write a check every quarter and pay their taxes, and then when they file their taxes on April 15th, had to write another check and write the first quarter taxes of 2014, you would see a tax revolt in this country like none other. But the simple fact is it's withheld from everybody's check and they never think about it. All they do is look at the net check. They don't really look at the gross. They look at the net, what they bring home. So in 1954, the filing deadline was changed from March 15th to April 15th. And, you know, in the 60s, computers started coming into the picture. 65 was the first toll-free telephone site for the IRS. And 72, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Division separated from the IRS, became an independent bureau at that time. 74, we had ERISA. Anything else interesting? 92, you could file returns electronically, and I guess the rest is fairly unremarkable. But I wanted to get out there, let you know that the first income tax was under President Lincoln. We don't think of Lincoln as the income tax president. I think of him as the first Republican president, because the Whig Party was opposite the Democrats prior to President Lincoln. But, and I think President Lincoln, regardless of your political bent, President Lincoln, everybody has kind of a fondness for that president. And he's kind of a favorite of many, many people. But so anyway, that's kind of the history of income tax and the IRS. Now, today, it's important to understand who pays the income tax. The bottom 50% of income earners, bottom 50% pays 2% of the total revenue in income taxes to the federal government. So the bottom 50% pays 2%. So that would logically have us conclude that the top 50% pays the other 98%. And it's true. It does. The top 25% pays 87% of the taxes. Top 10% pays 70% of all the taxes. Top 5%, 59%. Top 1, 37%. And the top 0.1% pays 17% of all the taxes. It's what's known as a progressive income tax. Okay, so the more you earn, the higher your percentage that you pay. Now, from a psychological standpoint, what does that do? That discourages people from making more money. I've often said we ought to have a regressive tax where the more you earn, the less you pay as far as a percentage goes. That would encourage people to make more money. By the way, just as a side note, that term, make money, that's strictly an American term. Did you know that? Before America existed, the phrase to make money was not a phrase in the world. Americans created that phrase. We were the first major significant capitalistic economy where we were able to not only adopt the phrase to make money, but we were able to make money. We were able to increase wealth through labor and innovation. Anyway, so what we're doing by penalizing high income earners. I mean, you think about, and I'm not going to reveal any numbers on myself or anything like that, but you take that top 10% of income producers, and they pay 70% of all the revenue to the federal government. What could happen to this economy if, instead of the government confiscating that 70%, that it was put back into the economy? Do you care? Do you care that the top 10% pays 70% of the income? It has been beat into our heads that if we're not into that bracket, we shouldn't care. Just because Bill Gates is in the top 0.1%, do I care what he gets taxed? Darn right I do. The less money he has to do things with, that all trickles down to the rest of us. And I don't want to hear any emails about trickle-down economics has been proven false and that kind of stuff. It has not. It's the media telling you that trickle-down doesn't work, that rich people save money. Well, you know, money is never, ever static. Remember what we said before, that money is really credit. So if a rich person makes more money than they need, more money than they want, more money than they want to invest, and they stick it in a savings account in a bank. Do you think the bank takes that money, sticks it in a coffee can, and slides that coffee can in their vault? Of course not. They loan that out. That still is working. And if people who have the means to save money didn't save money because they're giving it to the federal government to blow, then that's that less money in the economy that circulates. We've talked about the velocity of money and the effect that has on the economy. So all of these things come into place. So we have this progressive tax return that the tax rate that penalizes people to produce more. Now, I'm not a parent. I've never had children. So by definition, that makes me an expert on raising children. And I know that if you penalize a behavior in a person, you get less of it. If you reward a behavior, you get more of it. So by penalizing people who make more money, you reach a point of diminishing returns. This is the Laffer curve. Arthur Laffer developed this, said there you reach a point where increasing taxes does not increase revenue to the government. And that's what, that's what he's saying is you're penalizing a behavior such that people will figure out ways or modify their behavior such that they lower the penalty that they're experiencing in their income. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion on the IRS and get you some more initial historical facts to amaze your friends and family with. I'm Gary Rathbun. This is Sign Your Money. We'll be right back.
Now back to Eye on Your Money with Gary Rathbun.
We are back. We spent quite a bit of time tonight talking about the IRS and some of the history behind the IRS. Rates have changed almost every president. I mean, President Kennedy lowered the income tax rates when President Kennedy first took office, sticks to my mind, the maximum federal rate was 94%. And he made the famous statement, when the tide comes in, all the boats rise, which is a variation of the trickle-down effect. President Kennedy lowered taxes considerably when he was president. Of course, President Johnson created the concept of the Great Society. So he didn't lower taxes very much until President Reagan came into office. And President Reagan lowered tax rate. He increased the marital deductions and all kinds of stuff. He really revamped a lot of the income tax code and caused revenue to go up significantly into the federal government there, thereby creating more evidence of the Laffer curve that when you lower tax rates, you increase revenues. Now, obviously, both curves have a limit. If you lowered tax rates to zero, it's unlikely you would increase revenue to the federal government. But there is an equilibrium point there. And, you know, there's been talk off and on over the last 30 years. I mean, I remember when Steve Forbes was running for president or the presidential nomination in the 80s, I believe. He had a simplified income tax form that was essentially a postcard. Remember that? He said you can file your taxes on a postcard. And it was a flat rate tax. You took your income, you multiplied it by a flat rate, gave you a third number on the tax postcard, and you sent it in. Essentially, no deductions, no exemptions, nothing. How much did you make? Flat tax rate, say 10%. I think Steve was talking somewhere between 10 and 17%, or maybe even 7%. I forget. It's been a long time. But essentially, it was a flat tax from the standpoint that no matter how much or how little you made, you paid the same rate. So what that did, it took away the penalty of making more money. You could make more money and know that you weren't creeping up in brackets. You weren't increasing the bracket on your total income. They reach a point where you make one more dollar and your tax rate goes up significantly, causing you a lot more in taxes, where if you didn't make that dollar, it wouldn't apply. So, and then I think it was Neil Bortz kind of spearheaded for several years what he called the fair tax. And the fair tax was more of a consumption tax. Some people assign the terminology a national sales tax to it, and I'm not sure that was entirely accurate on the fair tax, but it was essentially a consumption tax. And if you made money and then spent it and spent over a certain amount, you would pay a tax on that. And it was like a sales tax. I mean, it was collected at the point of sale. So it's a little bit different. I don't think we'll go that way, but I could see us going the way of a flat tax. And it's going to take a complete change in government people, a complete change in attitude throughout the country. You're going to have to do a complete change in how the government spends money. But I think that would solve a lot of issues. I mean, think about taking all the deductions out. That would take away a lot of the lobbying, a lot of the favoritism, a lot of the fraud. You could get rid of the IRS and save that budget. So there's a lot of advantages to that, a lot of things that make sense, but not real optimistic it's likely to happen. So that being said, we'll see how this plays out. I'm Gary Rathbun, and this is Eye on Your Money.